CataractCoach.com. Welcome to our podcast. Today's episode 13 with Dr. Randall Olson. Dr. Randall Olson is the chairman of the University of Utah Department of Ophthalmology, the Moran Eye Institute, a program that he basically built from the ground up, starting off with just himself as the sole faculty member to now a huge department that's nationally ranked in the top residency programs in the country every year. Truly an amazing story. There's so much to learn from him. He also goes into details about what's the future of ophthalmology. It was so good that I made a note in the podcast and even said it, that I want to record this and send this to my own children so they understand how important ophthalmology is going to be in the future. Think about this. An entire lifetime of 20/20 or better vision. Near and far. Yeah, seriously. Check it out. You're going to enjoy this so much. Welcome back to another episode of the Cataract Coach Podcast. Today we have Dr. Randall Olson, chairman of the Moran Eye Center in the University of Utah. And we're going to talk about the history of cataract surgery, how far we've come, the path to innovation, what the future of cataract surgery holds, and also the amazing story of how the University of Utah's ophthalmology department has come so far in such a short period of time. It's a highly ranked residency program among the very best in the country with incredible surgical volume, and even innovative things such as the international ophthalmology program that you guys started. So welcome, Dr. Olson.
Thank you, pleasure to be here.
So tell us briefly about your path. You and I trained at UCLA for residency, albeit many years apart, but after you did your training, what got you back to Utah, which is apparently where you did undergrad and med school, and what convinced you to go into academics and build such an incredible center?
So I trained a long, long time ago. Doesn't seem that long ago, but I guess for those of you who are younger ophthalmologists, it is. I trained from 74 to 77 at UCLA. It was a great program, and Brad Stratsma was, when I think about it, very willing to consider new technology where many programs wouldn't. We were allowed to do phaco when many places wouldn't even think of it. It was almost an evil thought. Limited, but we're allowed to do some intraocular lenses. And so I had that input, and then they allowed some people in the community. Bob Sinsky was the one that I was able to work with and learn some skill in phaco when many people weren't considering that as a viable alternative. So that, I think, got me started, and it was one of the first new, big, fancy, all-inclusive eye centers, an institute where there was research going on, teaching, beautiful building, all of that kind of stuff. So that gave me an idea about what might happen. But the plan was that Brad had set up that I was going to go away for 2 years in cornea, and I was going to do a year fellowship with Herb Kaufman.
Now,
at the time, it was University of Florida. That's when he was the chief of the University of Florida. And then I was going to do a year with Klaus Dolman at Harvard, and then I was going to come back to UCLA and join the faculty on the corneal team. So that's my expectation. I was fired up. I already had been doing some research and some publishing, and I just liked the idea of being involved in teaching. So for me, an academic career was already a guarantee. So I get with Herb. And Herb's at University of Florida, and he makes the decision that he's going to build an eye center as well, an institute, and he gets a great situation where there's a lot of commitment to do that at LSU.
Gotcha.
So he is going to LSU, and then he has a commitment from a person who's going to join the team with him when that person, for personal health issues in the family, backs out. And I'd only been there about 5 months. And he comes to me and he said, Randy, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I want you to be faculty member, go to LSU, and we're going to grow this whole new, brand-new center. And you know a lot about it from UCLA. And we're just getting started from scratch. And it's just going to be you and Tom Zimmerman to start. And the two of you are going to get this launched up. Mind you, I had 5 years into my fellowship, or 5 months into my fellowship, and all of this is coming together. Called Brad up, and it was a classic example of miscommunication. Is that when I told him about it, and what did he think? He said, "Well, Randy, I trust you'll know to make the right decision. What he was really telling me is, you won't do it. What I thought he was telling me, hey, it's up to you. Do whatever you want. So I thought it over and liked the idea of trying to build a new place. And so I made the decision that I was going to stay. He was not pleased, is what I was told. But we have a great relationship. That's all water under the bridge. But at the time, he was not pleased. So I headed out to LSU. LSU at the time was, I mean, it's hard to describe how bad the program was. The residents had never met the chair.
Whoa.
They largely just taught each other the same. They had a few rooms. Everything was old and decrepit. Everything was done at Charity Hospital, which was a mess at the time. And then Tom Zimmerman was there. And so we finally got started, but it started to grow. Herb joined us after we'd been there but a couple of months. And we had some space that had been involved for a family medicine think tank as part of LSU. And he got caught up in some scandal. My understanding, was sent to prison. And that was the space that we were utilizing. But that's the start of it. But I saw how it was done, put together. And Herb, because he didn't have a neuro-ophthalmologist and felt that I'd had good training, which I had. Bob Hepler was a very good neuro-ophthalmologist, but I was not a neuro-ophthalmologist. But he had me doing the neuro-ophthalmology. Uh-huh. And the neuro-ophthalmology for that region, particularly with Charity Hospital, was really complex, serious stuff. And I did not want to be the neuro-ophthalmologist. So I kept bugging him. Herb, you got to get us a neuro-ophthalmologist. You got to get us a neuro-ophthalmologist. So one day he walked into my office and he said, this would be now early 79. He said, I found us a neuro-ophthalmologist. But he said, before I tell you who it is, I want you to remember that program is nothing and you're too smart to want to be involved in a program that's nothing. He said, who is it? He said, it was Henry Van Dyke, who was the only ophthalmologist at the University of Utah at the time. And I'm okay. I said, well, I really appreciate the fact you've got a neuro-ophthalmologist coming. And Henry was a fantastic neuro-ophthalmologist, great teacher. But what were they going to do? So I tried to check to find out because I thought, you know, I think we could build something pretty spectacular. There's nothing in the Intermountain West.
Sure.
And I kind of seen a really successful program and I was involved in building a program. But nothing came up, nothing mentioned. And so I cold called the chair of surgery, because it was a division of surgery, one-person division of surgery, to ask, you know, what they were going to do to replace Henry Van Dyke. And the chair of surgery, Frank Moody, a real character, and he kind of went on, ophthalmology, they were a royal pain in the ass, and I hated them. And Henry, and he and Henry locked horns all the time, I was told. He said, I'll tell you what we're doing. We're not even going to have ophthalmology at the University of Utah. We're just going to get rid of it.
Okay.
Oh, well, I don't think that's a really good idea. He says, well, I just don't see that it's really that important. He was a general surgeon, you know, a general surgeon. Sure. I said, well, you know, I think that you can't really have a good modern center without an ophthalmology program. No, we're just going to have the private doctors in town do what we need for teaching, and we're just going to neglect the rest. And anyway, I guess I've always had the gift of gab, and I convinced him that at least I should come out. So he said, if you're willing to pay your own ticket and cover your own costs, you can come talk to me and see if you can convince me whether or not we should do something. So I did.
Challenge accepted.
I came out, and he finally said, well, don't expect a penny from surgery, but if you're willing to come and give it a shot, see if you can build a program, I'm willing to get you try. Are you willing to do it? And I said, you're on. I'll do it.
Okay.
And so my entire recruitment package, finally the dean said, we can't do that. So the dean paid for my moving expenses. But other than moving expenses, our entire recruitment package was that. Nothing.
Oh, boy.
And when I think about now, what people insist on for recruitment packages. So one of the first people I called was Alan Crandall, who was in my class, and he was already a rising star at University of Pennsylvania. He was with Harold Shea, Shea Eye Institute, and Alan and I went way back. We did pre-med together, of course, medical school, and And Alan, being Alan, just said, I'm coming. I said, Alan, whoa. I said, I'm not sure I'm going to survive a year. You got to give me a chance to see whether we could even, he's claiming he's not going to let us do, I mean, we have to pay for everything out of our own function here. But I said, if I survive a year, I'm going to give you a call. And so we did survive a year. I called him, and Alan, same way, just said, I'm coming. I said, don't you want to discuss what I can get you for a salary or this? I said, Randy, you'll take care of me. Just get me a contract. I'm coming. So we started from very, very humble beginnings, but already started to grow. And there are a lot of different chapters in that overall story. But, you know, here we are. I'm looking out across the Intermountain West here. It's a gorgeous spring day, snow in the high mountains still. And, you know, we're in a 210,000 square foot building with about 70 faculty members, a residency that when I see the quality that are coming in, and Uday, I thought I was a pretty good medical student. I don't think I could match in my own program. I don't think I would be competitive. And they're just doing an amazing job, and how many faculty and how on every front we've had so many people buy into that vision. I just pinched myself. I can't believe how lucky I am that we are where we are.
Wow, from such humble beginnings to such an incredible institute. That's really amazing. And probably the hardest part, too, is not only is growing it, obviously the growing pains are getting bigger and bigger, but then you did the magical thing of recruiting the Moran family to support you.
Yeah. The one advantage I have of starting for one person division is that there was no baggage to carry, and everybody here has been recruited. So we're all kind of all part of that same overall history. And people who come here, you know, do it because they want to kind of buy into something that's maybe a bit different, a little more collegial, a little more trying to work together. Trying to help each other. I like to think in a way that, you know, there's a lot of great places out there. I never want to sound like I'm criticizing others, but I think we got something pretty special going on.
You got some good special sauce. Well, you also had the idea of being very cutting edge. As you were saying before, when you came to UCLA for residency, doing FACO was not widely accepted, and putting IOLs in eyes, I mean, there was a saying that IOL is a ticking time bomb inside the eye, right?
Yeah, Richard Trautman, I'll never forget the talk he gave where he put an intraocular lens with a time bomb on it and essentially stated that all of these eyes were going to be destroyed, which was not the case. But yeah. Alan was part of that early on as well. I recognized that we had to let the residents be looking towards the future, not what the past was. But Alan, where he had trained, Harold Shea would not let him not do FACO and not do intraocular lenses. He wouldn't let anybody at Shea use an operating microscope.
What? That sounds so crazy now.
Yeah, I know. In hindsight, you look at that. But loops were good enough for him, and all this other stuff was just hoopla, and it didn't really make any difference. So Alan had to go to other places outside and sneak out so he could learn. Of course, he was naturally an incredibly gifted surgeon. But we agreed between us that no one knows for sure exactly what the future is going to be.
Sure.
But we know it's going to be different. And so every time we'd go to a meeting somewhere, we'd sit down and said, now this is an interesting thing that could be important. And so we agreed that we'd want the residents to be involved in it. We'd want to see how it went. So, you know, we're the first program in the country that made FACO, you know, a key part, the most important part of your overall training. I think one of the first that routinely do lenses, foldable lenses, sutureless, I mean, you name it. And Alan, I give him a lot of that credit. But we agreed up front that we wanted to make sure one of the first program the residents were doing refractive surgery, that if it was new, interesting technology, rather than be immediately negative about it, as we had seen way too often, that we should accept change is going to happen and not just grab it willy-nilly we thought it was a stupid idea, but that we try to be humble enough to recognize it's hard for people up front to really judge something, whether it's good or bad, without having some experience and time on their hands.
Yeah, you got to try it. But I think that's an important lesson, is staying on the cutting edge. I know that after practice, certainly I don't operate the same way that I did in residency or even 10 years right. ago.
Right.
Things keep advancing.
Right. Right. So, if you're not changing, then you're stale and you got to be listening and looking and to see what's out there. I will say, though, at ASCRS now, having been at this at Moran now for 44 years, it is interesting to hear what some people are claiming as new ideas. And I remember, whoa, wait a minute, that actually was something that was presented and discussed and looked at and didn't work 35 years ago or 40 years ago. So we also at the same time have to be smart enough to think a little bit about history and not repeat things that have already been tried. But that's okay. That's part of change.
Yeah, learning from the lessons of the past.
Exactly.
So what do you think in your long career of obviously staying on the cutting edge and adopting newer technologies, what do you think are kind of the most important lessons, such as like keeping an open mind, trying technologies, maybe be open-minded, but be a little cautious?
Yeah, I've called it being skeptically open-minded.
Okay.
And that you never make a decision about something just off the top of your head. Because when you're doing that, you're often doing it based on partially emotional ideas. A lot of those things are, you know, limbic decisions. You're really not thinking about it very well. So recognize that when we do that, that is a way that humankind has evolved to make fast decisions when you have to make fast decisions. But those decisions when it comes to technology are often ill-informed and wrong. So you got to be humble enough to sit there and say, wait a minute, this maybe seems like a stupid idea, but think about it a little bit, you know, ponder it. But don't immediately accept, particularly be careful when it's just anecdotal evidence, because everybody thinks, you know, I love to say that so many science ideas and the rest are like a mother. Every mother's child is beautiful.
Yeah, and a genius.
Exactly. But not everyone is beautiful, right? Not everyone. And so think about it, you know, and yeah. ponder it. Be open-minded if it's something that's not too difficult to try. And so, you know, I mean, I remember Stephen Dewey when he first started with the Dewey tip, and he claimed that it really could reduce your risk for capsular breakage. I'm not so sure about that. But I talked to Steve, and I said, Steve, you know, I've got an idea. Let's test it. Let's see. And so, you know, we put out a paper, oh gosh, probably about 2005, which we showed indeed we could show using animal whole lenses that if you contacted the capsule with suction, that you decreased your odds of breaking the capsule about fivefold. That was clinically important, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So we published it. How much it helped everybody accepting that idea, I don't know. But at least we could sit there and validate. And frankly, after that, I used a Dewey tip. And so I like the fact that it gave me that little extra. And then the question is, well, do you lose efficiency? And we found for most modalities, we didn't. But some modalities, we did. And
because it's not as sharp.
Yeah, because it's not as sharp. In some areas, it didn't seem to matter much. In others, it did. There's a series of papers. And so that was the other big thing that you know, I love being involved in and where I could really help, particularly medical students who wanted to get attraction and buff up their CV, is a series of studies at looking at claims and then trying to say, could we validate it or not validate it? Did that really make sense or did it not make sense? And so that's been, and I still get a kick out of it. I still love posing those kinds of questions. And then, you know, getting students together on a project and then looking at the data and then saying, wow, well, I didn't think that's what it was going to be. Or, yeah, it's about what I expected. But just getting the data, seeing it, I still get a kick out of that. Seeing what the data is actually showing is trying to figure out what it is that is working and not working in this field of ours. So, but be open-minded, understand, and then try to think about, you know, where things might be going. You know, what's important, what the future might look like. So you're not sitting there, you know, mired in the past, but you're in a smart way looking to be on the cutting edge and looking to see, you know, where the future is.
What do you think?
Wayne Gretzky idea, you want to be where the puck is.
Right. What do you think is coming in the future for cataract surgery? You think, well, like on the IOL side, we have accommodating lenses. On the phaco side, are we going to have more something robotic? Are we going to have smaller incisions? Where do you think we're going with Vaco in the future, if you were going to guess?
So, I'll give you my general thoughts. I mean, I think that as far as the technology is concerned, maybe we'll kind of figure out better ways of using some types of laser energies that give us some less risk, but I'm not totally convinced that'll be the way to go. We've come pretty far in regards to how we can efficiently and safely use ultrasound. I think that capsular breakage rates less than 1 in 1,000 will be considered best of practices. There are people out there now that, I mean, we've got some of our faculty here that have gone thousands of cases without a capsular break. So I think that there's going to be a new, tougher standard around that. I think that efficiency, we're getting probably relatively close to about as efficient as you can do it. And sadly, we get stigmatized the better and the faster and more efficient we are, that the surgery itself is less important and gets less reimbursement. So, that's a sad thing that's happened overall. Just to put it in perspective, when I was at UCLA, now mind you, these were intracapsular extractions without an intraocular lens generally, but the residents used to get assistance fees of 20% of the main fee, and the assistant fee that would be paid for me as a resident is 5 times more than I get doing a Medicare cataract today.
Wow.
And the surgeon's fee was 5 times that. In inflated dollar change. One wag put it in Cadillac units. So
okay.
A UCLA intracap Medicare fee, 2 cataracts would buy you a Cadillac.
Wow.
2.
What's the number now? 200?
They were getting about $2,500 as a surgeon's fee for a Medicare cataract.
In 1977,
dramatic across the country, but a Medicare cataract sitting there in West LA. That's what they were able to get back in the early 70s.
And that's $1,977 or whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah. So if you take it, so that same $5,000 cataract today is probably $60,000. And what? We need to do 100 cataracts today.
At least.
At least to be able to buy that. See? So that shows you how dramatically those kinds of things have changed. And that's another area that I have a concern. But just talking about cataract surgery, I think we've got some really exciting areas. I've worked hard, and I've got a financial interest, so let me say that. But we've been fascinated with that with a perfect lens and the idea that you can, adjust a lens to perfection. And there's a whole host of reasons why that's not really taken off, and it should. It's not the technology, but it needs to go. But one way or another, we're going to be able to provide incredibly precise refractive outcomes. And if it isn't exactly what you want, we're going to be able to tweak it. We'll be able to change it. We're going to be able to adjust it. You may try some elements of depth of focus. You don't like it, you erase it, you do something else. All of those are theoretically possible. In vitro, we've already been able to do a lot of that stuff right
now. Wow.
So I think that more and more people are actually going to get, call it either really early cataracts or refractive lens exchanges, more and more people, because it's going to be such a powerful refractive principle. And on top of that, I think that we're going to be able to customize higher order aberration correction after the fact, so that we can optimize over what Mother Nature is giving. And so I can see people in some pursuits wanting to have this done just because it gives them that extra edge.
Almost superhuman vision, right? Almost superhuman.
Yeah. Theoretically, where our cones are set up, they say we should be able to do something like 28 or maybe even 26. We certainly have plenty of people who are 20/10.
Wow.
And with an optimized system, that'll be part of the fun part, is that we'll have some form of machine. I see in the future will be an adaptive optics, which saying if we correct everything, here's what you could see. Is it worth giving it a try? And then we could actually duplicate exactly the same thing after a lens is in the eye, where you already know where the, because it's really critical when you do those kinds of things that you're centered on the optical axis.
Sure.
And then after the fact, be able to do that. I think people will see that. I think that'll happen within 20 years. There's no reason it couldn't happen sooner, but I've just learned things take a little bit longer than they should. So I think that's going to be an important part. So way less complicated. Complications, you know, extremely uncommon. And we'll be using principles that I think we could change with lenses that will decrease dramatically dysphotopsy and those other issues, which is another effect that we need to get around. I think we're really just beginning in the glory days for cataract surgery. We've had an amazing period, but I think the future is going to be incredibly bright. And I think more and more of all the refractive is going to be at the lenticular level, where you have this kind of precision and the ability to do that. I think we'll get much better true accommodative lenses at the same time. And one of the big problems with accommodative lenses that I don't hear a lot of people talking about is that if we're going to have true accommodation, it's going to depend upon what's the pressure in the capsular bag. And once you have a system that will respond to that, think about this. How do you know where that lens is going to sit in the resting state? Yeah. It could easily be sitting a bit hyperopic, a bit myopic. That's a whole other set of criteria. So once you know what the resting state and you have a lens in place, the ability to go in now and adjust the resting state to suit to absolute plano, correcting higher order aberrations, then you got the best of all worlds, right?
So you get a combination of the perfect lens with the accommodating.
Exactly. And then you can go back in, and over time you can adjust that. Because even where we are now, we figure we've got at least five different adjustments that you can put in an eye at a lens. And there's no reason why we couldn't figure out how to, you know, stack that even more tightly and go forward. So I see the future for the ophthalmologist is that particularly when presbyopia is set in, is that you've got an accommodative lens with good range of function. You zero that system down. You zero that sucker right down to perfect. And then people come in. Rather than getting a new pair of glasses, they come back in every 2-3 years and get it retweaked as another procedure. And that's going to be the very important part of the ophthalmologist practice in the future, is seeing that people have this incredibly precise vision that's in place that you continue on. As far as other areas of ophthalmology, a little less on the front side, I'm really excited about where we're going for different forms of gene therapy. We've got a gene therapy for macular degeneration, in which we can provide the effective area of a protective protein for complement factor H at levels that are as great as those that are at homozygous protective, which is highly protective against macular degeneration, as a single-shot gene therapy. And we're already in clinical trial doing that right now for our own brand product. So I think people in ophthalmology, if you want to look at the different areas, I mean, I'd be really nervous in radiology. I see artificial intelligence and the rest doing most of what they do and probably doing it better. But I don't see that for us. I think, and we'll have more and more of ours that is not, it's going to be direct to consumer because the quality is so good. And that we can provide, you know, the kinds of things that, that you know, enhance their ability to do things, you know, through life. And so I think ophthalmology is really, it's been kind of the golden special. I think it's going to be even better. I don't know, what is it going to be, platinum? Maybe lithium is what it's going to be in the future, right? But I think those that are listening and looking at this, I think things are going to be incredibly exciting for the field. I mean, we've just launched this new, because of, you know, Alan, my dear friend and colleague, who was so important for everything we did here, passed away here a few years ago, tragically. We're just have launched the Alan Crandall Center for Glaucoma Innovation, and Ike Ahmed has agreed to take leadership of that
overall,
put that in place. And so we're trying to duplicate what we've done with macular degeneration with the same incredibly intensive phenotyping, genotyping, you know, studying. All the people in the study donating their eyes freshly afterwards, like we've done before, to really come up with new ways of treating that. And so with all of those different things in place, I think we're going to see a lot of our chronic diseases as well under control. And it'll be a pretty standard thing that we can give people unbelievably good, uncorrected vision throughout life with most of the major diseases largely under control. And I think the new ophthalmologists are going to see that as the standard in their career.
And something important you said too is direct to consumer. So getting away from a third party payer.
Yeah, we can't be controlled by Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, we'll always have an important part to play because we got to take care of that population. But
for sure.
I mean, we will have such good quality we can provide that a lot of those Medicare cataracts have already been a refractive lens exchange with them coming and getting it tweaked for perfect vision. And that's not going to be something that insurance pay for. And we don't want insurance necessarily to be involved because they continue to be unwilling to pay, you know, what it really deserves and not even willing to keep up with our inflationary costs. So you just look at those lines and what's happening, and that's not what's going to allow us to fund the kinds of things that we want to do. We don't want to be a huge outlier, but I think we can provide such quality that there's going to be enough capability for people to, you know, to pay for things that aren't outrageously expensive. Let's face it, people pay for their glasses now.
Right.
What did it cost your patient the last time they went and bought a pair of regular glasses and sunglasses? How much did they and they wanted to, you know, put the top coat on your rest? It's not uncommon today. Those people are out of pocket $1,200, $1,500,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
So sure. It would be nothing for them to come back and directly for us to treat their eyes better than they could ever get a refraction. I mean, we've already been able to get accuracy down to like 0.08 of a diopter, right? And so we pop it right dead on, and for them, and say every couple of years and pay $3,000. I mean, for me, that's not going to be a difficult sell at all.
So what are the things you can adjust? Obviously, spherical power, astigmatic power, probably some higher order aberrations like spherical aberration. What all things could you adjust?
So we can already tweak coma. We can tweak spherical aberration, trefoil, quadrefoil.
Wow.
Really, that's your imagination. I mean, there isn't anything that I see that can't be done. And you can do it all in the same package.
Those
aren't individual treatments. Those are all. So in one treatment, you could correct at the same time. In fact, even as in, you know, trying to talk to the FDA about this, get away from this. We're going to do spherical and they're under cylindric because what we do, it's just as easy to do a spherocylindric correction as to do a spherical.
Sure.
So what's going to be involved in this is that you're going to figure out how you adjust this overall pattern so that you correct cylinder, sphere, coma, spherical aberration, all in the same treatment to make sure it's whatever is perfect. And we've never been able to do that before. So it may be perfect as a little bit of, you know, negative spherical aberration. I mean, that'll be fun to find out. See, people
right,
like you
right.
and me will love studying that for outcomes and looking at saying, well, what now that we can finally do all that stuff, what really works best for people? Maybe what works best for people in the middle of the day isn't quite as good. So that we'll find that those people that drive at night and the rest, that, you know, there's a little tweak on that they like better. I mean, those are all the kinds of things that will be part of the future as people get to meetings and discuss and decide what's the best overall pattern. But just think about it. We're not talking about being able to do it. We're talking about we can do it. Now, what's best for the patient? That's going to be a lot of fun.
That's really neat. And I love the idea of being able to periodically adjust it. Like you 5 years later, you develop a little bit against the rule still, no problem. Get you right back
on. And you know that's going to happen, right? I mean, our eyes overall are always going to adjust from width ruled against the rule because of lid pressure. And we know that there's other changes that happen. And, you know, even people that are pseudophakic, where they're not having as lens change, there's always a little bit of changes that happen. So I just think we're going to see that's what patients are going to do. Rather than get glasses, the optical dispensing business isn't going to totally go away, but they're going to be under some real competitive pressure because
sure.
they can't do the kinds of things we're talking about.
So I could foresee a future now that more and more of the population is becoming myopic. You know, you basically get to like, let's say 20-ish years old, you get your corneal laser vision correction done, and then some point in the future when you hit like late 40s, you get presbyopic, you get the refractive lens exchange done, and you basically spend your entire life without glasses.
Exactly. And, you know, you think about it, I think that there's really not a person, you know, in the developed world anyway, who is going to escape not wanting to have some element of that. They may not. They may decide to go glasses. That's fine. But I think a lot of them are going to recognize that this is a better way to go. And we'll have the tool set and the rest. The pressure on the surgeons will be such that more and more, I mean, they're going to have to show that they can do this surgery with a complication rate of less than 1 in 1,000, which I think with the new technology, the rest will be easier and easier to do. Endophthalmitis, I think we're already with, intraocular injections have come a long ways, but, more than 1 in 10,000 will probably not be acceptable, so that people know 99.99% of the time they can go in there and get that surgery done. And then the tweaking is an outpatient 15-second procedure.
Wow. So you must then have to have an eye tracker then, right? Because I imagine with treating these little slight aberrations, a coma and trough wall, spherical aberration, you got to be pretty precise on the way you're doing the adjustment.
Yeah, it's gonna be no more precise than what people are trying to do with the latest cutting edge LASIK. So yeah, you're gonna have to have suction ring, and you're gonna have to have a fail-safe tracker that if the eyes move beyond, that it doesn't fire, it only fires when everything's lined up the right way. But that's all an engineering issue. And frankly, the cutting edge LASIK manufacturers have already figured most of that stuff out.
For sure, yeah, the lasers do it now, 400 or 500 hertz even.
Totally, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So this isn't, some people are like, oh, is this Olson, he's got his head in the clouds. I've been accused of having my head in the clouds my entire career, so that doesn't bother me at all. But be as it may, I don't see anything that I've said. I mean, in my own mind, I don't see from an engineering standpoint that there's any of that that's not doable. And University of Rochester, they've got their own work. It's a little different way of doing the same thing. So there's already two companies out there that are moving in a similar direction of tweaking the refractive index to produce a lenslet inside of the lens with incredible precision. And if you can do that in a variable pattern, then this is all doable. And we've already done it in vitro.
So it's a good time. Right? If you're one of our younger ophthalmologists here and you're like 30s, it's a fantastic time to be an ophthalmologist. We have an amazing future coming up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I know people are really worried, but I just see that what we're going to be doing is way, way more of this kind of thing. Just before Charlie Kelman died, I remember he and I were together at a little session and meeting. And I just asked him about, kind of like you did to me, about what he saw in the future. He said, Randy, he says, I don't know when it's going to be, but you'll see the day when there are way more refractive lens exchanges than there are cataract surgeries.
Wow.
And I thought, whoa, I don't know. That sounds pretty wild. But he's right. We haven't seen it yet, but I think that day's coming. That day's coming when I'll bet you we're doing 2 to 3 refractive lens exchanges for every cataract surgery. And we're doing fewer and fewer cataract surgeries, which is for the national good, right? Insurance companies don't have to pay for that. Why? Because the lenses have already been, the lenses have already been removed, and now they're all into tweaking it for perfection.
So patients hit Medicare age already pseudophakic. So Medicare's happy.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because we can add. And if we can't, they'll do it because we've added the value. So it'll be up to us, but I don't think that'll be hard. For presbyopic patients with other issues that are, particularly facing some loss of vision due to early cataract, I think this is going to be an easy decision to make.
Yeah, even in my own practice now, probably about 10% of the IOLs I do are for refractive lens exchange, not for cataracts.
Add what we just chatted about.
It's going to be 90%.
Where you can tweak it to perfection. You can improve their overall visual quality, essentially guaranteed to 20/10, maybe even better. That's not people are going to be saying, sign me up. They're coming in the door saying they want to have it done.
Yeah, I can certainly see the future where I'll be doing 90% refractive lens change and only 10% of the IOLs would be actual cataracts.
Right, right. And those are easier cases to do. And we'll get technology that will make it even safer to be able to do it, to see that we just regularly can make all of this happen. And we can make it happen in a way that, like I say, capsular breakage is a maybe once every couple of year event.
Wow, that'd be neat, yeah?
Yeah.
So, exciting time to be an ophthalmologist. Now, switching gears here, you also, at Utah, your center has a great experience for residents to be able to go and learn to do MSICS and charity-type surgeries in other countries.
Yeah, I really give Alan Crandall... Alan, those who knew Alan... he had a big heart. Early on, and as we were moving together, he hated to charge patients, and we were just trying to survive. And I kept seeing that our billings were way less than the surgery he was doing. And I remember going to Alan, I know that, you know, I just didn't think they could pay it. And he was always paying out of his own pocket and the rest. So, I mean, he's just got just a heart as big as gold. And he got involved and really one of the most important, we ran into John Dow, and he'd done a little bit of work. And John Dow was one of these child soldiers, incredible history in South Sudan, gone on and talked about the need. And Alan, just being Alan, said, I'll go.
Wow.
And I, first of all, Alan, South Sudan is a disaster area. The whole Darfur area is just, you know. But he went, and he just fell in love with it. So a lot of his career was involved. And so we sent up this, the Division of Global Ophthalmology, and we started looking for dynamic partners. Jeff Tabin had a big part about this because we recruited him about the same time. And he had other centers of excellence. And so we've got a series of partnerships where we're striving to help them, you know, raise their game. They come here and we train their people. And then we give them support. And then we go there and work with them. And we felt it was critical to make that just a core part of the program. And so, and Alan was a leader, and Alan, you know, he wore it on his sleeve, on his heart. It was, and I was fully supportive. My job is to see that we gave people the freedom and flexibility and paid the bills. So it is a very important part of the program. And I've got Craig Chaya, who is one of the glaucoma specialists that Alan trained. And Jeff Petty's in charge of all of the educational aspect of that, which is also huge. But both of them are very involved, in these different partnerships. But yeah, we provide time for all of our residents and all of our fellows too to go on these trips. And then we ran into people on the Four Corners area and the Navajo Nation saying, "Well, you're going all these other areas. We've got need here." Sure. So we've set up a model program for the Navajo Nation, and all the residents take part in that as well. We're finding need in areas on the reservation as bad as sub-Saharan Africa, which is really tragic in this day and age.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Until we got in there, there's a long story that we could go. We could spend another hour just talking about that. But it's a very important part of the program, a very important part of our budget, because I'm the one who has to pay the bills. So I was, okay, all right, we'll figure it out. But we've got residents involved not only in training people from other countries so they can get their certification.
Sure.
And then be able to go back, and then going with them, you know, trying to find people who can, you know, can do glaucoma surgery and do retinal surgery and pediatric surgery and the rest. And then our residents and fellows have all been engaged in spending time working with the people who come here, and then going back to, you know, the host country with them, and get a chance to learn all these skill set and be very involved. And we've had many of our residents who've really taken that as an important part of their vocation going forward, is always be engaged in this type of effort. So it's been, you know, marvelous to see how much people are willing to give of their time and effort to do that.
All right. Should we be training more ophthalmologists? That's like, there are only like 460 residency spots in the U.S. per year.
Yeah, we have not changed dramatically. We have been a plus or minus a few from 500 for my entire 44 years. In fact, we actually were training probably a few more, because we had a bunch of these one-person residencies, largely based in private practice, that, you know, all got killed off by the Residency Review Committee. And we seem to be kind of stuck where we are. It's a interesting governmental policy that has made that so. It used to be, in my day, residents made academic programs a lot of money.
Sure.
We, like I just told you, I mean, we used to get $500 in 1974 dollars for me to sit there and assist on a cataract surgery and just put drops on the eye. That's what the Jewel Stein got, $500. So let's just do the math. They were paying me back in those days. See, my resident salary was $800 a month. So, you know, put it in perspective. I would do just a day a week. They, you know, a full day back then would have been five cataracts. So they were making $2,500. So they were making, just on that alone, they were making about $22,000, let alone they could bill for clinic patients we saw, else we saw. They had us, because back then we had inpatients, and we did all the workups on the patients, so they charged for that. I'm guessing that they were paying me $8,000 a month, and they were making off me in 1974 dollars, something like maybe $40,000 or $50,000, right? They were making good money. In today's money, they were making $200,000, you know, net profit off of a resident. So once it was decided that the federal government was going to pay resident salaries through direct and indirect medical education, specifically direct medical education, the decision was made, if we're going to be paying for their salaries, you can't bill for their efforts. So they killed that one off immediately. And then, and it's not totally true, there's some private insurances, but it's so hard. Very few people bill anything for resident activity anymore. By and large, they killed that one off. But at the same time, there were so many not very good programs that saw an opportunity for a line that residency salaries were just booming at the rate of about 25% per year. And there were a lot of places that were just looking at this as a cheap labor, you know, generally in areas like, you know, family medicine and internal medicine and peds. And the quality was awful. And so the federal government said, nope, we're putting a cap on it. Can't get any more money. So they killed the ability for it financially to be viable. And then they added all these rules so that, you know, now rather than necessarily that there's money to be made in association with a resident, not that that was the main goal, but they did make money on us back in those days. Right now, the average resident costs a program something like, after your salary, you're still with the additional expenses, they insist, it's probably like $120,000 per resident a year cost.
Sure.
And you have to come up with all of the salary and fringe benefits, whatever they may be involved, if you're going to do a residency on your own. So if you can't find an ACOGME certified direct medical education spot, they're just not happening. And so we've been restrained, and that's why we're sitting where we are. Now, with an aging population, and at the same time with the kinds of things that I'm, you know, we're talking about, where there will be a lot of need to be directly engaged, I think it does make sense that we're probably expanding our residency corps. I know that people are always worried about overpopulation, but when you consider how rapidly they're expanding the optometric side of things in comparison to ophthalmology, we, as a percent of the population, are actually been dropping, right? Because we're stuck the same we are now for all these years. So, in fact, I worry. I tell all my residents when they graduate, you know, there were people who worried about whether or not there was a competitive landscape where they could have a practice and make money and move forward. They've all done okay. Nobody's starved as an ophthalmologist, don't get me wrong. But if you wanted to go in a really popular area, it was pretty tough going. And I said, what I worry about in the future is that it's just the overwhelming pressure of trying to take care of the need and not having enough people to do it. I think we're already there. I've got people with great practices, huge amounts of surgery in less desirable places who've told me I never had a hard time finding a resident, you know, who wanted to come and practice in the area. I've now gone 3 years and not had one decent applicant.
Wow.
And I don't know, I'm sure it's for you at UCLA. I mean, our residents, they've got multitude of opportunities. Most of them are doing fellowships, and then they've got, a lot of them are getting you know, a total package in some cases from good academic programs even before they start their fellowship.
Sure.
That's the kind of pressure that's on right now when we're trying to recruit, you know, that top talent. So, yeah, I think it's time. I think it's time for us to, you know, to start expanding some of these programs and start figuring out a way where academic centers are under real financial stress right now, where we can make that a viable option.
Because, yeah, with what we're talking about, you're going to have a huge increase in the volume of surgery that needs to be done.
Right. And so, I'd say I see the future where the average anterior segment surgeon is going to be just kind of standard to be doing 1,000 cases a year. That's just kind
that's
of
only
like
20 a week. That's not all that much. 20 a week.
No, when you're talking with the kind of quality and the rest and everything that's putting in place, and you're talking refractive lens exchanges, and that's something that's real difficult. That's going to be a breeze walk to do that, you know, but I could see that, and that's going to take a lot of, I mean, those patients have to be seen, they have to be evaluated, every one of those is going to be come back every couple of years to get a retweak, right?
Yeah.
Think about it. To put that on the present cadre, and the fact that, I hate to use these statistics, but they are pretty interesting. The average ophthalmologist out of training today in regards to a lifetime RVU productivity level comparison to one who came out 40 years ago, like me, that your average lifetime RVU productivity is probably going to be about 40% less.
Wow. Why do you think that is?
I think it's smart. I mean, I think the idea that, you know, for me back in the baby boomer, that you were proud of the fact you put in 80 hours a week, worked yourself to death, had 3 divorces, all of that. I think there's a greater emphasis on quality of life. So I don't think people are willing and interested in, you know, in working that hard. It's going to be more important that having children, raising children. There's just a host of different societal pressures, which I think are positives, are such that what had become standard. So I just see that there's going to be a different overall productivity level. And again, with the same number, that means that there's even going to be a greater shortage.
Sure.
And I know that people look at that as that, am I saying something? I'm trying not to be politically incorrect here. Don't get in trouble. I think these are good things. And I'm big in the fact that we've got to make these changes. But just looking at the hard numbers, you add that all up, and we're facing some real serious shortage, I think, of ophthalmologists, particularly considering the kind of golden age that, you know, you and I have just blue-skied about.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. Yeah. Well, I think it's definitely going to be an amazing time. I'm certainly looking forward to it, especially with all the new technologies coming, new opportunities. I still have such a huge love for surgery. You know, on Cataract Coach, we put a new cataract video up every day.
Right.
We have 1,800 something videos, and people say, my family asks, how do you think of new topics? It's like, it's cataract surgery. I can make a million videos. There's always something new. There's always something neat.
That's the fun, isn't it, right? You look at it and you see these things, and there's always, oh, look at that. That's interesting. When you get to the subtle areas, it's the little things that start counting. Like, well, that was a smooth move. I think earlier in my career, I would even realize, I didn't even know enough to know that was a smooth move.
Right.
And you would say, okay, I got to give that a try. That makes a lot of sense. That's the fun part about it.
Yeah, I think we're blessed to be in this field. I think I'm thankful every day that I'm an ophthalmologist.
Yeah. There's been some statistics out there, and they've been variable. But by and large, when they ask people, you know, what's the most popular field, we often compete with dermatology as the most popular field. But when you ask, if you had to do over again, you know, what would you have decided to go into? We usually beat dermatology as the one that most people say. And I think that's right. I think we really do have the best of all worlds.
Yeah. Hopefully my kids will listen to this podcast and maybe follow suit.
I hope so.
All right, Randy. I want to thank you. It's been a fantastic hour chatting with you.
Oh, my
Learned
pleasure.
So much. I'm really super impressed with what you've done at Moran. You just really created from the ground up such humble beginnings.
Too kind.
No, it's obviously a world-class place, so it's really amazing.
But thank you.
I want to thank you again, and I'll put some links below for our listeners if they want to check out more details about the Moran and what you built.
You got it. Appreciate it, sir.
All right, thank you.
You take care. Thank you now. Have a good day. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thanks, Dr. Olson, and thank you, our audience, for enjoying this podcast with me. I know you learned a lot. It was very insightful. Part of the history of ophthalmology that we don't get to learn about, really. It was really an enjoyable time. Remember, we do have these podcasts available audio only. Amazon, Google, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find this. Search for Cataract Coach or search for my name. It'll all pop up. And remember, doing a new podcast now every week, every Sunday, you get a new podcast because there's so much to learn in ophthalmology. Plus, it's a lot of fun. I'll see you next time.